So I titled my talk tonight, More Suffering or More Happiness. And basically, this is the choice that the Buddha presents in his teaching. At one point he said, I teach only suffering and the end of suffering. Or if you don't like the word suffering, I teach only unsatisfactoriness and the end of unsatisfactoriness. It sounds a bit more clumsy, that's all. And this is based on something called the Phula Dhamma Samadhamma Sutta. This is in Majjhima Nikaya number 45. And this sutta uses a sort of a classical structure that you see in several other suttas. In fact, I'll refer to another of the suttas later on. Where basically, the Buddha says, well, there's this and there's this. And so you can have A and B, A not B, B not A, not either of them. So like there's always, yeah, two things, you got four choices of how they combine together. And this is a classic teaching pattern. You see this not only in Buddhist teachings, but in other traditions as well. And it's a way to sort of see that mainly what it is a way to see that we actually have choice, number one, that we can actually choose wisely and change the direction of our practice and our life for that matter. So, this is the second verse of the sutta. Bhikkhus, there are four ways of undertaking things. Four ways that we could do things, right? What are the four? There's the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. There's the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There's the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. There's a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. So there's four things. Pleasant to start with, but painful in the end. Painful to start with, painful in the end. Painful to start with, pleasant in the end. Pleasant to start with, pleasant in the end. And these are the four things. And these four, when I thought about it, they sort of talk about different aspects of life and practice, how we experience life and how we experience practice. So the first one of these, pleasant to start, painful in the end. This is a pretty good description of how we're told to live our lives. Our culture says, go out there and indulge yourself. Have a good time. Don't worry about stuff. But in the end, this just creates pain. Ignore the fact that you're going to get old and get sick and die. Pretend that isn't true. This is the basic message of the culture. And also, it's like how we live our daily lives. It's like, let's just find all this pleasant stuff and enjoy ourselves all the time. Not that pleasant stuff and enjoying those pleasant things is bad. It's just that as a strategy for being ultimately happy, it doesn't seem to work. So there's a saying that we hear about, that we hear, it's just sort of, maybe it was very popular in culture back in my day. I don't know if it's still so now, but it's a moment on the lips and a lifetime on the hips. And this is like, having that little bit of sweet stuff when you paid for it later, right? And this is often how we consume things. We consume things because they're pleasant. And whether I say consume in the broadest sense, so I'm not just talking about food or alcohol or drugs or anything like that, but media, everything that we might take in, everything that goes in through the sense doors, we choose. And sometimes you choose things that are pleasant in the moment, but don't in the end really do anything. This is why I stopped watching really violent movies. I'd watch things that were like, oh, it's so well acted, and it's, the director's great. I had all these excuses for watching these things, but I always ended up like feeling really crummy afterwards. And it was like, oh, this is actually affecting my mind state. And even though it was pleasant to watch because it was like I was amazed by the skill of all the people involved, in the end, it was like pain in the end. Pleasant, it was pleasant in the moment, painful in the end. I want to read something Joseph Goldstein has to say about this. This is from his book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about right effort. The eighth step, the sixth step on the Eightfold Path, which is really, in some sense, what this sutta is talking about as well. And basically, the first step in right effort is to not try and not do things that lead to suffering. Try not to create causes and conditions that you're going to suffer. This aspect of right effort points to a fundamental understanding of how our mind works. In the suttas, the most pragmatic description of nibbana is the mind that is free from the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when these defilements are not present. That's also very important to note, that this isn't like our constant, some people say, life is just full of, greed, hatred, and delusion all the time. Well, it's not. We also have these very wholesome moments, sometimes wholesome times. Yet, we've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when those defilements are not present. You have also had unwholesome factors frequently reemerge as conditions change. This is the function of what we call latent defilements, mind states that are not present in the moment, but have the potential to arise whenever the conditions for them to reappear are present. It is just this understanding that can inspire a feeling of spiritual urgency. When we're leading basically good and wholesome lives, it's easy to become complacent about our current circumstances. But even under these favorable conditions, we still have many moments when greed, hatred, and delusion arises. We see something beautiful and we want it. Our mind is pulled towards it. Or perhaps we see somebody doing something we don't like and the mind is suddenly filled with judgment and aversion. Or we may be tired and the mind simply dulls out in delusion. So the first of the four great endeavors is recognizing the enduring power of these latent defilements, understanding what gives rise to them, and preventing them from arising and taking hold. So this is the first step in right effort, doing whatever you can to make sure that unwholesome mind states don't arise, which is pleasant in the start, painful in the end. That's why we want to do that. We want to make that right effort, because otherwise, there we are, ending up in a painful mind state again. Stick a bookmark there. So that's the first of the three. Then we have painful to start, painful in the end. And this is actually also a good description of how we sometimes act. It's a good of these habits we have that we know cause us and others to suffer, but we continue doing them anyway. And we all do this. These mental habits and the actions involved with them become sort of who we are. We sort of define ourselves in a certain way that is painful. Even though they're painful, they're like, well, that's who I am. We sort of create this idea of how things are and how things should be and who we are, and ignore the fact that These things never work. Never. It's like, what are we doing? But this is also a very good description of addiction. This is the world of addiction. Like, it's painful when you do it, and it's painful later, but you do it anyway. Whether this is like physical addiction to alcohol or drugs, or addiction to cell phone usage, or addiction to, who knows? You can become addicted to pretty much anything unwholesome pretty easily if you're not careful. This is also, I love this as a definition I like. Insanity is repeating the same action over and over again, expecting a different result. That describes what we're talking about here. Insanity is repeating the same action over and over again, expecting a different result. Somehow I think, oh, well, this time it's going to be different. It's going to be great. It's going to stay great. I know it is. But it isn't at all. It never is. So actually seeing these things, these things arise in the mind. Everything arises in the mind at the level of intention first. And we see the intention to think or act or speak in a certain way that we know is painful right as we're about to do it. We know it's going to be painful, but we do it anyway. And this is where mindfulness is so powerful, because we say, oh, I recognize that. I see that for what it is. We talked a while back about the phrase, I see you, Mara. We see that this is an unwholesome thing. A pain is going to be painful, and it's going to lead to more pain, both for ourselves and others. And then we go, okay, I don't need to do that. Or more likely, while we're still learning this skill in a sense, here we are in the midst of it. Here we are in the midst of doing this thing. And then we go, oh, wait a second. This is the thing I told myself I had to watch for because I know where this goes. I can stop it right now. I can maybe even apologize to other people involved in the process if I've done something harmful to others. I can actually shift how I work. This is the second form of right effort. When an unwholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to end it. This is where choice keeps coming in our lives. We can see, oh, I know where this goes. I either don't have to start doing that at all, or I have to go, no, here I am in the midst of it, starting to rant again about whoever you rant about. We all rant about certain things. I go, I don't need to rant anymore. I don't need to, I know the ranting just makes me miserable. And the people around me, oh, there's that Barry ranting again. Makes them miserable too, right? So let's just step back and not do that. Once again, Joseph has things to say about this. And he's talking about, in this case, he's talking about how, what this is describing, painful to start, painful in the end, is really talking about how the kilesas, the hindrances, affect us and how we habitually keep getting caught by the hindrances. And this is what Joseph has to say here. At times, though, the hindrances may be tenacious, and we need additional strategies for abandoning them. In one sutta, the Buddha describes five techniques for dispelling distracting thoughts and unwholesome mind states. This first is using its opposite as an antidote. So there you are, caught in some rant about somebody, and instead you say, okay, instead I'm going to practice metta for that person. I'm going to try and have thoughts of loving kindness towards them instead. Shift the channel. For example, if ill will has arisen, we can refocus the mind on metta. Or if restlessness is present, calming the mind through calming the breath can be helpful. We feel ourselves getting wound, you know, how we get wound up sometimes. And we just go, I think I'll just step right back and just focus on the simplest thing I know, which is the breath. This is a really skillful thing to do in meditation sometimes. And I'm not saying you should use it as a way to escape the unpleasant. Sometimes we have to actually look at the unpleasant and take it in. But then after taking it in, we can go, okay, I see that for what it is. I see you, Mara. I know this. I'm familiar with it. Now let's just still the mind. Let's try and cut down the chatter that's whirling around in my mind about all this. And just do some simple thing like paying it, just having mindfulness of breath and nothing else. Just shifting the channel again. If envy or jealousy is strong, we can turn the mind towards the feeling of mudita, empathetic joy. All of these remedies come from understanding that we have an inner remote control with an ability to change channels. This is sort of advanced mindfulness in some senses. Like originally, when you're first taught mindfulness, the instructions are always just pay attention to whatever is arising. No matter what it is, just pay attention to it. And that's fine. That's great up to a point. But at some point, you know, I've been on this channel many times. I've looked at it carefully. I see the unwholesomeness of it. I understand this isn't working for me. Time to change the channel. Let's just shift away from that unwholesome pattern into something more wholesome. And this is where the skill in practice is knowing when that's appropriate. When it's appropriate to go, nah, I don't need to go there again. I've looked at this, I understand it, now let's let that be. The second means of removing unwholesome states already risen is the factors of hiri and attapa, often translated respectively as self-respect and respect for the wise. These wholesome factors of mind bring a heightened sense of conscience and responsibility for reflecting on how the wise might view an unwholesome mind state or activity is often a powerful ally in this endeavor to abandon what is unwholesome. For this reason, these factors are called the guardians of the world. Care is also needed here so that the review of our actions is done from a place of wise understanding and not simply feeding into patterns of self-judgment or guilt. There's that fine line. This is where mindfulness practice and Western psychological practice are starting to blend in answers like this. Like, it's understanding that we have, especially in the West, this habit of judging ourselves and beating ourselves up all the time. And if we're not careful, this idea of conscience, of doing what's wise and correct, turns into like a hammer we whack ourselves with. And we don't want to go there either. That's just, here I have one unwholesome pattern. Let's add a second unwholesome pattern on top. Doesn't really work that well. There's suffering, and now we get more suffering about our suffering. Joseph would want, but used wisely, hearing attapa can awaken us from the power of deluded thinking. I love that statement. We can remove us from the power of deluded thinking. Because often this is what's going on in these, painful to start, painful in the end. We're deluded into thinking, this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be great. How many times do we catch ourselves doing that? That's delusion in its classic form, where we think somehow or other it's going to be different because we want it to be. That's deluded thinking. And stepping back and going, but I know this isn't a good idea. Here I am in the midst of this and I can see it isn't a good idea. that's wholesome effort. I don't need to do this anymore. Okay. Then we come to the third of these things. Painful to start, pleasant in the end. This is a pretty good description of what practice is sometimes like, right? How often have you said, God, this practice is difficult? You know, it's really like I have to work so hard, and sometimes, some days it's like, ugh, you know, there, it's time to go sit in that room again. And the last thing I want to do, I want to sit here and, you know, eat some Wheaties for breakfast for a change or whatever it is. You know, your mind is just like, no, don't want to go there. I think in the morning because that's my practice then. It's difficult to keep a regular daily practice and to go on retreat sometimes and go deeper into practice. It's difficult. It can be quite painful. I've had some retreats where that were like a month long of being unpleasant, but I learned a lot in the midst of all that unpleasantness as I struggled with it. So it's painful and painful to start, but then the learning, the wisdom, the wise stuff arises, and it really gladdens your heart when you see that wisdom arising from that struggle that you had to go through. Yeah. As we learn to start paying attention to what is arising, instead of just reacting in aversion to anything that is unpleasant, we often end up experiencing painful memories of the past and worries about the future. We gradually learn to transform these unpleasant moments into moments of true insight, which leads us to more happiness. So this is the third aspect of right effort. Do whatever you can so that wholesome mind states arise. And sometimes doing whatever you can means it's going to not be that pleasant to start with. But you know from experience, from practice, that doing what you're doing leads towards happiness. And this seems like, you know, I've talked about this to people who don't practice. And they think, God, that sounds pretty masochistic, right? Why go through something was so difficult and painful, and why struggle with it at all? You know, because, you know, our whole culture says, no, just do whatever's pleasant. And sometimes you have to choose things that are difficult and some, and maybe not the most pleasant thing. And when you think about retreat, you know, and for instance, well, you know, I have no TV, I got no radio, I got no internet, no cell phone, no nothing. Don't, no music, nothing. I'm just got what the contents of my mind. This can be pleasant. It can be extremely pleasant. It can also be quite unpleasant and quite difficult at times. It's a struggle. It's painful at the beginning, but it's pleasant at the end. And this is right effort. This is the third form of right effort. Do whatever you can so that pleasant, unwholesome mind states arise. Then we come to pleasant to start, pleasant in the end, which is what, this is the one we all want, right? This, oh, why can't I just have pleasant to start? Why can't I have just that one, right? This is also a description of practice sometimes. You know, there are times in the practice when that are just incredibly sweet. It's like, you know, you just, you know, it might just be a particular sitting, or it might be a day or a week or in a longer practice session where we just, oh my God, this is just great. This is working so well. I'm so happy. This is the fourth aspect of right effort. You know, when a wholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to maintain it. And I'm not saying we've got to grip it, because as soon as you grip it, as soon as you try and force it to make it stay, now you're just caught in desire and it's going to go away just like that. So you have to be careful. You have to be gentle with it. But it's like, if you're having, you know, one of those days of times of practice, you just go, okay, I just had a really nice, pleasant sit. Now my day is going to come along. I have to deal with the stuff that's going to come through my day. I think I'm going to just be a little slower today. I'm just going to take my time today. I'm not going to rush into things so much. And maybe even, later on today, though I don't normally sit a second time, I'm going to actually sit again. I'll deal with all that stuff in my inbox and all those phone messages. And then right before lunch, and maybe I'll just sit for 15 minutes, but I'm going to take another sitting period just because this is what I'm experiencing right now. Pleasant in the beginning, pleasant in the end. So we do whatever we can to maintain unwholesome mind states once they've arisen. Because all those pleasant mind states are just like everything else. They arrive, they're there for a while, and they're gone. It's all those pleasant mind states we have in practice and in life are temporary. There's no difference between the pleasant ones and the unpleasant ones. They arise, they're there for a while, they're gone. So let's, when we're in the midst of a pleasant space, let's do whatever we can to sort of maintain it without grasping it, without trying to force it. Just seeing if I can consciously see how this pleasant mindset has arisen in some sense. Go, okay, let's go with this. Yeah. And knowing it's going to go. Absolutely, it's going to go. But let's see if I can make it sort of string it out for a while. And this also points to the fact that it's really important that you enjoy your practice. There's got to be time when what your practice is joyful. If your practice is always grim and you're always struggling and you're always going, oh God, there's another place. Oh, there's another unwholesome. And turn it into like this really sophisticated spiritual way to beat yourself up again. But this is unwholesome. It's got to be, we have to acknowledge the wholesome when it arises and then do whatever we can to keep it going for a while and enjoy it. Like really like, oh, this is the good stuff that they keep talking about. And sometimes those things come and go and they don't come for a while and you feel sort of stuck, in practice. I've had fairly long periods of time where I felt like, oh God, nothing's happening at all. I'm just stuck. And then something shifts and, oh my God, here I am in this pleasant space again. It's just, that's the nature of practice as well. It's not in our control. Other than we can consciously see things and do what we can to sort of steer. As Joseph says, his image is changing channels. For me, it's like, well, I can't stop the car from going forward, but I can steer. I can go over this way a little bit or over that way a little bit. And that changes the story, changes where I'm going. And that's what practice allows me to do, is to skillfully steer a little bit. So this sutta, which I just actually read the first part because the rest is just basically explaining what I just talked about, has another sutta that is a parallel to it in a sense. This is another one of those ones where there are these two things and four choices. And I want to look at it just because I want you to see how this pattern in the Buddhist teaching gets repeated. And also it points to things from a different angle in a sense. This one's sutta number 17 in the Majjhima Nikaya called Jungle Thicket. I think it's a great name for a sutta, Jungle Thickets. And this is, I want to read you the first couple of verses of it. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket, which is basically what the Buddha did. He said, go out, he told his disciples, go out, sit out, go out into the forest there, and just live as simply as you can. You know, do your rounds once a day to get dana, and other than that, stay out there in the thicket, away from everybody else, and so you'll be alone in practice. Here, because a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket, while he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. He does not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. And also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth, robes, alms food, resting place, and medicine requirements, are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living in this jungle thicket. While I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness has not become established, etc., etc. I do not attain the supreme security. And the requisites of life are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should depart from the jungle thicket that very night or that very day. He should not continue living there. Then he goes on. This is verse 4. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in the jungle, some jungle thicket, where he is living there. His unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction, etc. But the requisites are easy to come by. So his practice is not going anywhere, but he's got lots of food and a nice place to stay. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living in this jungle thicket, blah, 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 blah. But I got lots of great stuff. Having reflected thus, the bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket. He should not continue living there. So this is the pattern here. Basically, you're not succeeding and you have poor requisites. Time to go someplace else. Time to move on. You're not succeeding, but you have good requisites. Time to move on. Don't let the good requisites, sort of the easiness of life, keep you there. The practice is succeeding, but there's poor requisites. I'm succeeding, but you know, life is hard. Stay anyway. Because practice is growing. And then there's the practice is succeeding and you have good requisites. Well, let's stay there too. But you see the pattern. It's exactly the same pattern as the other one. It's just, it's a different set of things to think about, but it's exactly the same pattern. If things, and all it's talking about, how's my practice doing? That's what makes the decision, not how easy is my life. How's my practice doing? This is a good way to think about our practice in our lives. You know, it's like, it's sometimes it's like we get so caught up in making sure our life is on a day-to-day basis great, easy, that we don't have enough time to practice. And our practice isn't succeeding. And so we have to go, oh, maybe I have to have a little less of this stuff that makes life wonderful. So I can have more energy over here putting that into my practice instead. This is where life is difficult in practice, because practice requires that you give up stuff. You know, I mean, remember, this is a practice of renunciation. We have to renounce having everything wonderful all the time so that we have time to practice. This is not easy. But this is basically how we can take this, because we, you know, we're not mendicants, we're not monks, we're not nuns, we're not dependent on the villagers we go see once a day for our requisites, right? We're householders, we have to create our own requisites. However we do that. And we have to start looking at what it is how much emphasis we put over here in getting good requisites and how much emphasis we have over here and putting more energy into the practice. That's how we can take this sutta in the sense, apply it to our daily lives in a sense. And the interesting thing about the sutta is that this is like called jungle thickets. Then in another place, the sutta goes on to say that the same applies wherever the bhikkhu might be practicing, in a particular village, town, city, or country, or dependent on a particular person. The advice doesn't just apply to renunciates. In other words, like, if my practice, no matter where I'm practicing, no matter how I'm living, if my practice isn't growing at some level, and we have to be very careful not to be too judgmental about our practice, because that's now how we're beating ourselves up in yet another sophisticated way. But if it's not, you can sort of see over time that things change with practice. And if that's not happening, then I have to go, what do I have to do to make that shift? And that's where we have to, that's a skillful thing you have to look at sometimes. Can I shift my life so that my practice goes somewhere further, more skillfully? And so, this is the last comment. I wrote two things down here. Both of these suttas are pointing to two very important things. Number one, we have to step back and look at our life and practice sometimes. It's so easy just to keep going on, not stopping and going, let's step back and look at this big picture thing, not just sort of caught up in the day-to-dayness of life, which is very easy to get caught up in the day-to-dayness of life and just sort of keep on rolling along. Do I have to stop and, you know, can I step back and look at the big picture? You know, am I too bound up in requisites? Am I too bound up in doing things that always lead to painful ends? Can I, on a sort of a big picture look at things, see that and go, well, I can change that. I can shift that. I can make wise decisions and use wise effort here in a broad scale, not in a moment-to-moment thing, but in a very broad scale. And the other thing I noticed, how we decide what we do in our life should be directly determined by what effect it will have on our practice. A big ask. But this is like, what's the most important thing in my life? My practice. Okay. If that's the case, then everything I do has to, every decision I make, every important decision I make, has to have that in mind. How does this affect my practice? Can I move, and I'm not saying this is going to happen right away, but can I move towards being like that more often? I'm about to make an important decision, and you can go, yeah, well, what does this have to do with my practice? How is this going to affect it? Is this going to move my practice forward, or is this going to just be in the way of my practice? It's a difficult thing to do because, there's so many other variables, and this just has to become the number one variable in all our decisions. This is the thing that I think about before anything else when I make a big decision in my life. What's the effect on my practice? Of course, I have a little bit of poetry to reflect this. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, and it's called "And a Voice Spoke in the Twilight." I haven't read this one to anybody in a long time. I'm just going over my poetry. And a voice spoke in the twilight, "For I will carry you across the wide river of life and see you safely to the other side. Be unafraid and joyous. On this shared journey, you will see miracles. You will know sadness. The heart of your heart will be glad. And at times you will suffer, but there won't be a single moment when you'll stray from the path. If you could only believe that right now, this moment is part of the journey, perhaps you'd see the futility of worry or despair. I will carry you no matter if you find the way easy and safe or rife with danger and impossibility. I will keep you in the presence of God and in the light of truth. This is my covenant with you. I speak soul to soul, and I say only what is true. With that, the night went back to stillness. There's a very clear description of an intuitive insight that could arise in practice. This is what this is. And it speaks very clearly to the fact that it isn't always pleasant. Sometimes practice is difficult, sometimes life is difficult. Oh, what a surprise. This is the scribe's life, how we live our lives, and how it is sometimes. Not always great, but it can always, everything can be fodder for practice. We can actually start paying attention to things and be mindful of them, then we can learn from many things that arise that often we don't want to even look at. Let's look at them all instead. And be okay with that. That's really what all of this has been about today.